playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands. Playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the Irish Times Weekend Edition. Your weekend's in good hands with our sumptuous food features, intrepid travel stories and engrossing sports coverage.
Good morning and happy Bloomsday. Well, given the mixed weather, it's hard to believe that last Saturday we were basking in glorious sunshine. So, in County Wicklow, 2,505 women descended on Mahramore Beach, stripped off and dashed into the waves in pink wigs to break a Guinness World Record and to fundraise a shedload of money for the children's cancer charity, Aveen's Pink Tie. Well, such were the joyful shenanigans that the story went viral and the footage was broadcast all over the world. Ray Darcy caught up with the woman behind the skinny dip and the Guinness record, Dee Featherstone.
Breaking actually doesn't do it justice. You smashed it.
I absolutely annihilated it.
Yes, you did. You did. It was because of your personal story that you organised the first one.
Yes, I was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2012. And after my chemo and my mastectomy, I just really wanted to do something fun. So a few weeks after the mastectomy, we decided to do this strip and dip. And I blackmailed all my friends and family into it. Basically, I said, listen, I'm bald and I have only one boob. And so, you know, they couldn't say no to me.
Atmosphere there. Not everybody has a connection with cancer. For a brilliant cause, it's for Aveen's Pink Tie. How much do you reckon you'll make from Saturday's strip and dip?
I think for Aveen's Pink Tie, at the moment we're at 297,000, and donations are still flying in from everyone all over the world at the moment, which is fantastic. So I don't know, maybe mid-300s, I should say.
300,000, it's very hard to raise that amount of money in this day and age. And it's gone viral, as you say, all over the world. Now, why do you think it went from how many last year?
Around 220.
Yeah, so it's more than 10 times.
Well, I think the Guinness World Record was a big draw.
Yes.
I mean, it really was. And sort of most people, after they do the dip, they always say they're going to bring three or four friends the next year. So that got us up to around 1,200. And we had a lot of PR behind it as well from Aveen's Pink Tie. And it just escalated. Like, even up to a few months ago, we were over 1,600 people. And in the last couple of months, it just skyrocketed. People were begging to go nearly at the end.
Apart from the numbers, was it like something has changed for women in Ireland? Or am I reading too much into it?
No, I don't think so. I think Ireland and all the issues we had recently with the referendum, the Magdalene laundries, you know, what's happened over the last few decades. And I think a lot of women wanted to do this to empower themselves. You know, there was a lot of people there, not only had been through cancer, but they might have had body issues, mental health issues. Like, everyone had their own little story to tell. And I think these women just really wanted to do this. And afterwards, when they came out of that water and we were talking to them later, it changed a lot of people's lives. It's just incredible, the stories that are coming out and the empowerment of the day for women in Ireland and the 22 countries around the world that took part.
From the Ray Darcy Show on Monday. Well, not such a fab, fun ending for Irish Ferries passengers due to travel to France in August. Their holiday plans have been thrown up in the air with the cancellation of all summer sailings on the new WB Yeats ferry. The company is blaming a shipyard in Germany and claims the cancellations are due to circumstances beyond its control. Catherine Dowling is caught up in the nightmare. She spoke with Sean O'Rourke.
My family were travelling as a large group. We're supposed to be travelling on the 3rd of August and we'd booked on the WB Yeats to go over. There's 9 of us across 3 cars and we got the email yesterday saying the ferry has been cancelled. So we had to kind of move pretty quickly because I know they said they were going to get in touch with us and try and reschedule. But I didn't kind of want to wait in case by the time they got onto us, the days that we wanted had gone or that we were having to travel. Like, my sister is going and her partner, they have no more days of annual leave left, so they couldn't be moved to an earlier booking or anything like that. So they're going out now on the Brittany ferries sailing from Cork, but they have to leave a day later, and so are my parents and my youngest sister. So they're losing a day of the holiday at the start, and they're also losing a day of the holiday at the end because sailing home on that ship leaves on the Friday instead of a Saturday. And then myself and my husband are now doing the land bridge with a 6-year-old and a 4-month-old. So that should be fun.
You took the words out of my mouth. It's a different proposition when you're trying to land bridge.
Yeah, it'll be a long drive. Like, we'll be leaving on the Friday, the 3rd of August. We'll be leaving our house at about 6 in the morning to get the 8:30 ferry to Holyhead. And then we'll be driving from Holyhead down to Folkestone and staying the night there. So we're kind of thinking Google Maps last night said the journey should take 6 hours. Now, I think that's a very, very optimistic. So I would say if we get to the hotel by about 10 o'clock that night, we'll probably be doing well. And then the next morning, we have to be up and onto the Channel Tunnel then and drive from Calais to Normandy, where we're staying.
Well, I don't envy her that journey. From today with Sean O'Rourke on Wednesday. Well, one person who will definitely be travelling in August from Rome to Ireland is Pope Francis. He's planning a whistle-stop tour on the 25th and 26th for the World Meeting of Families. It's the first papal visit in 39 years, and it's a jam-packed 36-hour schedule with a trip to the Marian Shrine in Knock, Mass in the Phoenix Park, a visit to Brother Kevin to meet homeless people at the Capuchin Day Centre. But alas, the Pontiff won't make it to Northern Ireland this time round. For Drive Time, Barry Lenehan spoke with Mildred Byrne. She was on duty at Knock Shrine.
This morning when the news came in at 11 o'clock, well, I was jumping for joy. I was so pleased for Knock and for the west of Ireland and for Ireland in general. But for Father Richard, who has put so much work into Knock Shrine, I was delighted.
I presume you'll be there on the day in question.
With the help of the Almighty God, we'll probably be on duty and that'll be great. And I look so much forward to it. On a time like this, you'll always get the odd renegade, you know. But certainly the West of Ireland and everybody in the West of Ireland is delighted. Plus the fact that he's using our beautiful airport as well to come into.
Tell me, the Vatican, it's promising plenary indulgences.
I get a plenary indulgence every time I go to Knock myself.
But will other people get the same perks if they go and see
Pope
Francis?
They will. I'm only kidding. Of course they will. I think Our Lady is sending us that every single day. And God bless him for coming. And you know, he couldn't come to Ireland without coming to Knock to Our Lady, because she's with us all the time, you know.
Barry Lenehan reporting for Drive Time on Monday. Well, the papal visit was also discussed on The Gathering yesterday by politicians Damien English and Richard Boyd Barrett and journalists Michael O'Regan and Colette Brown.
Confirmation of the details of Pope Francis's journey to Ireland at the end of August. What do you make of what you've heard so far, Colette Brown?
I think it's going to be a good trip. A lot of people are going to enjoy it. Don't have any problem with him coming here. And I hope it goes off without a hitch.
Damien?
Yeah, I think it'll be a good trip too. I hope it goes well. I think it's a big event for the state. Tisha's very clear on this, that the state will help. This is not a formal state visit, but it's going to be treated as such, and it'll be, I think it's a good story for Ireland.
I think the most important thing, obviously for people who are Catholics, they're absolutely entitled to have their representative come here and all the rest of it, right? I don't think the state should fork out a pile of money for it. That's disproportionate. But I do think, of course, if he wants to come, but critically, he has to open the Vatican's files on what it knew, when it knew, and what it did about cases of historic child abuse within the church. And it has to really engage with survivors of institutional abuse.
Yeah, I think it's a good thing. I hope it goes well. I'm particularly delighted that he's going to meet Brother Kevin. I know of Brother Kevin's work down the Keys. I've interviewed Brother Kevin over the years. I'm delighted that it's part of his itinerary.
From today with Sean O'Rourke yesterday. The importance of family was central to Myrtle Allen's philosophy of life, and her Quaker work ethic inspired the pioneering food dynasty that she created with her husband Ivan and later her children and their spouses, including Dorina and Rachel Allen at Ballymaloe in County Cork. Mrs. Allen died on Tuesday at the age of 94 after a short illness, and tributes poured in from culinary stars around the world, celebrating her vision in spearheading a truly Irish food revolution. John Howard is the former chef patron of the famous Cockardie restaurant in Dublin. He soldiered with Mrs. Allen, leading the charge on the culinary front in the days when we didn't know our camembert from our Calvita. He spoke with Claire Byrne on the News at One.
Myrtle was a friend to everybody who was interested or who knew anything at all or about food and food culture, and she's a terrible loss.
It's said of her that she pioneered an Irish food revolution. What would you say her contribution to Irish food was?
I'd say she did. I mean, Ireland, probably when I started training in the late 60s, it was a pretty poor place to be, you know, regards food and food cooking. The food itself was okay. The raw material was fine, but the standards were not very, very good, to say the least.
And so what then did Myrtle Allen do, in your view and in your memory, to change all of that?
Ballymaloe was a big farm at one time. She ran that farm with her husband Ivan, who since passed away as well. The farm wasn't paying, and so Myrtle was telling me that, well, you know, they had to do something. So they decided they were going to open a restaurant. And they opened the restaurant, and the rest is history.
Why was she so well regarded in the professional cooking community, John?
Because her ethos was very, very good. I mean, she only ever wanted the best of quality, the best of Irish produce, the best of Irish produce in season. She only cooked food in season. She didn't want the food imported from other countries. You know, her ethos was we should be self-contained. We had the best fish in the world, we had the best meat in the world. We had the potential to grow the best vegetables in the world. We didn't at that time, but it got better.
And do you remember a time when that ethos of Myrtle Allen and Ballymaloe began to spread and grow and have influence on everybody else?
Well, I think it was in 1968, an association was founded in Brussels called Eurotalk, or the European Community of Cooks, of which Myrtle and Paul Bocuse, the great French chef, who's since died only very recently, Pierre O'Meyer from Belgium, and Juan Maria Arzac from Spain, among others, founded what is called the European Community of Cooks, or Eurotalk. One of the ethos of Eurotalk was to protect the food quality and food cultures of each individual country. And Myrtle did that in spades.
John Howard remembering his friend Myrtle Allen, who'll be laid to rest at a Quaker service tomorrow at Ballymaloe House in County Cork. Well, like Myrtle Allen before him, Hugh Farnley Whittingstall is a chef and a warrior-like campaigner on issues relating to food production. He's launched Fish Fight, War on Waste and Britain's Fat Fight. And of course, he has a huge fan base here for his River Cottage television series. He describes himself as a runaway from the city, trying to find out how life in the country works. He was Ryan Tubridy's guest yesterday.
I was only mentioning there before you came in about the joy of fishing for a bit of mackerel off the coast last weekend.
Is there anything better?
I think that was one of the first things you did with your dad when you were about 5 or 6. You went out fishing with him. Is that right?
That's right. Although I have to say my first mackerel was a bit of a strange one because he took me on the bus in London with a bamboo cane and a piece of string and a bent pin, and he took me to fish in a stream in Richmond Park. And we sat there, you know, for 10 minutes or so with a lump of bread squeezed onto a safety pin, dipping it in the water. And amazingly, not very much happened. So he told me to toddle off for a walk and look for some worms to put on the bait. And as I had my back turned, I suddenly heard him go, "Hey, we've got a fish, come back." And I rushed back and came back, and he gave me the bamboo pole and I pulled it in, and dangling from the end of this piece of string was a beautiful, fresh mackerel. So I, for years, went telling all my friends that the first fish I ever caught was a mackerel in a stream in Richmond Park.
Yes.
And it was only when I was about 12 that he finally fessed up about the trip to the fishmonger, that he secretly had it in his bag all the time, that he stuck it on the hook. And yeah, I have to say, as a young teenager, when he told me that, I couldn't believe it. I felt such an idiot. But I'm massively grateful to him because that was the beginning of my love affair with fish and fishing. And you know, you mentioned Fish Fight earlier. I mean, if my dad hadn't done that, would I have ended up making those kind of shows or taking people out fishing in River Cottage? I probably would never have done it.
Hugh Farnley Whittingstall heard on the Ryan Tubridy show yesterday. Well, food was also the main focus on the documentary On One, which began its new season last Saturday afternoon. Does My Bum Sound Big in This? Told the story of Joyce and her battle with obesity. Emer Horgan followed Joyce for 2 years while she attended a weight management clinic and eventually went on a 6-week milk diet to help her prepare for surgery.
It's not as if Joyce has never tried to lose weight. She's a long and checkered history of joining gyms and slimming clubs.
Lost tranches of weight up to 4 or 5 stone. But once the gung-ho attitude slipped, and I wouldn't just go hell for leather and, you know, move into a chipper, it would gradually go back on. And invariably, I'd put on an extra stone, maybe 2. But about 10 years ago, I stopped trying. On those days when you feel lowest and the idea of a curry or bar of chocolate, watching the deli with the feet up, it doesn't seem like the greatest sin in the world. It's not scurrying off with a bottle of gin under your arm, wrecking the joint afterwards. It doesn't seem to harm anybody except you. And you don't even see it as harmful because it's comforting.
Even when Joyce was in what she thought was good shape, it was often not good enough for other people. In her early 20s, she was on a holiday in Turkey with a gang of girls.
I lost 4 stone going to the gym, doing loads of weights and everything. And I was sitting at the pool one day, feeling really good about myself, lovely tan, and splashing the legs in the water.
They were having a bit of fun fixing up the girls with the waiters.
Someone said, "What about Joyce?" And there was kind of a little bit of an awkward moment. I went, "Yeah." And I turned around and I said, "I didn't hear who you assigned for me out of the waiting staff." And it was like, well, kind of embarrassed, and they're all looking at one another, and I was like, "What?" And they didn't quite know how to say, "It won't be happening, girl, look at you." I was crushed. And I have to admit, getting up and going off with my towel and people saying, "Come back, come back." And I went back to the room and I got into the shower and I cried and cried and cried and thought, am I ever going to be acceptable? And I just kind of gave up. So here I am back again. Do you know any waiters?
But you did go out with people.
I did, of course. Yeah. I did snog a waiter, actually.
From the documentary on One, Does My Bum Sound Big In This?, produced by Emer Horgan and Nicolene Greer. And you can listen back to the entire programme on the Doc on One website. Over on Sunday Miscellany, recorded at the University of Limerick, sweets were on the menu as Donal Ryan remembered his late father.
This is a short poem I wrote for my father, who left this world last year at the start of a long winter. Dad was a poet, I'm not. He also, when I was young, was a sweet salesman, the best job a boy's father could have. In the summers, I used to go to work with him, and every day was filled with sugar and songs and joy. In memory of my father, who never missed Sunday Miscellany, this is called Sweet Van. Einstein said, time was an illusion anyway. So somewhere, we're still picking stock from the shelves of Paddy Hogan's warehouse, then driving west across the Shannon, over the clanking boards of the bridge at Portumna, my eyes closed against the fear of falling true. You're still singing Big John with the sun warm on your face through the windscreen. I'm still holding back my tears at the bit where Big John dies to save the other miners, because a boy old enough to go to work with his dad is too old to be crying at songs. Not that you'd ever have minded my tears. You'd have laughed and reached a hairy knuckled hand across, swiped it gently down my face, and sang a different song. In Einstein's time, Dad, you're singing still.
Donal Ryan heard on Sunday Miscellany. It was a good week for Irish writer Mike McCormack. His novel, Solar Bones, won the International Dublin Literary Award on Wednesday with a hefty cash prize of €100,000. John S. Doyle gave a succinct summary of the novel on It Says in the Papers.
As the Times Ireland describes it, the book is set over an hour, beginning with the Angelus bell at noon and ending with the news at one. But it tells of the lifetime's memory of one man and is written without punctuation.
So, appropriately enough, Mike McCormack was interviewed by Claire Byrne about his win on the News at One.
How important is it for you that nominations for this award come from public libraries in cities around the world?
Oh, it's absolutely crucial. The reach and the spread of this award across the world makes it absolutely unique and makes it a singular honour to be shortlisted and the eventual winner. It's a huge honour.
Now, your book is unusual, and I know you're probably fed up with people talking about the fact that it's a one-sentence novel, but it did spark fear of the unusual, didn't it, in publishers before it went to print? And indeed, I know from opening it myself as a reader, it's something that you have to grapple with for a moment before you come to terms with it. But the people who eventually did publish it, you've paid tribute to them for their courage in doing so.
Yeah, I did. The book went around the world, you know, in terms of trying to find a publisher, and no one wanted it. And then a small Dublin publishing house called Tram Press, they took it on, and everything that other publishers found awkward and unworkable, they said, no, no, we can work with that. They saw it as a virtue. They also had great trust in readers. They said, no, there's a readership out there for this book. We're absolutely convinced of that. And they put all their efforts and energies into it, and they brought out a beautiful edition. And I'd like to think that their faith in it was repaid today, and has been for the last 2 years now since it's been published. And still, people still talking about the book. And that's one of the amazing things about this prize, is that it has this kind of delay, so that books 2 years old kind of get a renewed life from that.
Will we be hearing from you soon? Are you working on something now, Mike?
It'll be a little while, but I am. Yeah, writers write. That's what we do. So yes, I'm working on another book, and it'll be probably next year, I'd say, sometime before it's published.
Well, writers write, and award winners bask for a little while at least in the glow of winning. So I hope you get to do that today.
Thank you very much. I would hope so.
Mike McCormick there with Claire Byrne. And he also gave a wide-ranging interview to Sean Rocks on Wednesday night's Arena. It was quite the week for fabulous writers here on RTÉ Radio 1. The Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Paul Muldoon was in town from New York. His work Incantata will be featured at the Galway International Arts Festival next month, reimagined as a piece of theatre. It's an elegy he wrote in memory of the distinguished printmaker Mary Farrell Powers, who died in 1992, a woman he describes as one of the great artists of the second half of the 20th century.
I met her in 1980 when she came to Belfast to take up a post as a printmaker for the Arts Council of Northern Ireland. And I met her, and I think it's fair to say I fell in love with her. And we lived together for 2 or 3 years, drifted apart, but we, you know, we continued to have a very good relationship. So her life, I'm afraid, came to an end much too early, 1992, as I say. She died of breast cancer, a breast cancer that she really didn't treat properly. In any case, she died much too soon. And I wrote this poem in a kind of fury, I think, in some way. I wrote it, it's long enough, but I wrote it in a period of 3 days. Unfortunately, there are more and more opportunities for writing elegies. I found myself writing a few more in the intervening years, but this one for Mary Farrell Powers was one that had a particular meaning to me, you know? So I'm delighted now to see that it's been taken up and will be presented now by the Galway Arts Festival.
And it's always a treat to hear a poet read from his own work.
Incantata, in memory of Mary Farrell Powers. I'll just read the opening. I thought of you tonight, Eliano, lying there in your long barrow, colder and dumber than a fish by Francisco de Herrera, as I exactoed from a spud the Inca glyph for a mouth. Thought of that first time I saw your pink spotted torso, distant near as a nautilus, when you undid your portfolio, yes indeedy, and held the print of what looked like a cankered potato at arm's length, your arms being longer, it seemed, than Lou's. And that, of course, is Lou of the long arm, the Celtic Mercury. And I mentioned there the pink spotted torso, which was the title, actually, of one of her most famous prints. And it looks very much like a potato. So in other words, this is the opening of it, just making a connection with her. And it's a poem which I suppose, like so many elegies, is an attempt to stave off that sense of grief by, I mean, this is very crude, and I think it's appropriately crude, just filling that space with bits and pieces of the world. So the poem turns out to be a litany, I suppose, of aspects of our life together, things that we did together, and, as I say, bits and bobs of the world.
Paul Muldoon heard on Sunday with Miriam. As you know, Dr. Gabriel Scally was appointed by Cabinet to head up the independent scoping inquiry into the cervical check scandal. And he was so frustrated at the delay in getting essential documents from the HSE and by the formats in which the documents were delivered, which thwarted his efforts, that he took to the airwaves to explain why his investigation, which was due to be completed by the end of June, will not now be ready until the end of August. He spoke with Mary Wilson.
The thing is, I'm going back in time quite a few years, and it's quite a number of a huge number of files that are having to be trawled through in order to find me the information. That's only one part of the problem, the volume and the complexity of it. And the format.
Why are they giving it to you in an incorrect format?
I don't know. And I think you'll see I am cross in the report, or at least I'm trying to modify my crossness, but it is unacceptable to be given reports that were generated relatively recently in a modern format for us to be sent them in a photocopied format that we can't search. And when we're dealing with thousands and thousands of files, it's really important that we are able to do a decent job of searching through those.
Dr. Gabriel Scally heard on Drive Time. However, there was some great news for Vicky Phelan. She's the terminally ill woman whose court case against a US lab blasted open the cervical check scandal. She spoke with Ray Darcy.
My phone rang and I saw the number. I saw it was Dr. David Findlay. He's my oncologist up in Vincent's. So I'd had a CT scan on Tuesday, but to be honest, I wasn't expecting to get a result until maybe today or tomorrow, you know. So when I saw his number coming up on the phone, I just went, oh, Jesus, do I really want to answer this, you know, because, I mean, I had been looking forward to the stunning gig for many weeks. It's really what, you know, it's been keeping me going. Like anybody, you know, if you're planning a holiday, that's what kind of keeps you going. And I was so looking forward to last night and so, you know, fired up for it. And then I saw this number and I went, oh, God, do I want to know? So I said, I better answer it because I knew he'd just keep ringing until I did anyway. So when I answered, I said to him, I said, look, Dr. Findlay, I said, if this is bad news, I really don't want to know. And sure, he nearly cut across me. He said, absolutely not, Vicky. Like he was bursting to tell me, to be honest. He said, this is just absolutely fantastic news. He said, you're just not going to believe it. He said, there is a significant shrinkage in your tumours. And I've only had 3 doses of this immunotherapy drug. So, you know, we were crying. We were, it was just an amazing, you know, and I was in the salon with my sister, my 2 best friends. It couldn't have been a better time, really, to get that news. There was mascara running down faces, makeup being touched up, but, you know, it was worth it. It was just...
And he was bursting to tell you because it's huge news for him as well as you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, outside of, obviously, the you know, good news for me, that this is obviously working. I mean, this is massive for cancer, Ray. I mean, he said that to me on the phone. He said, Jesus, Vicky, he said, you don't realise how big this is for cancer, he said, and for cancer patients in this country. You know, he's been campaigning to try and get access to this drug, pembrolizumab, for some of his patients with cervical cancer for about 2 years now.
Fantastic news. Vicky Phelan with Ray Darcy on Thursday. Well, while the 2018 World Cup is underway in Russia, the Special Olympics Ireland Games are in full swing here. RTÉ's Western correspondent Pat McGrath caught up with some of the athletes preparing for the gymnastic finals. But first, he spoke with Patricia Craven. She's the head coach for the Connacht Rhythmic Gymnastics team.
It's going to be hard work, but great fun. We'll be exhausted come Monday, but I have to say it's probably one of the most exhilarating things you could do as a coach.
Patricia Craven is the head coach for the Connacht Rhythmic Gymnastics team.
What happens is in rhythmic gymnastics you get a DVD and the entire world have to do the same routines. Our club picked 3 and they are the ribbon, the hoop and the ball. And practice, 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 and we try and perfect it here. Stay up on your toes, up, 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 up.
This week's games are the culmination of hundreds of hours of practice. Leah Costello and Maria Hannan are all set for their big moment and they're feeling quietly confident about their prospects.
Ribbon, a ball, a hoop.
So a ribbon, a ball and a hoop. So you've got 3 things to work on. And tell me, if you win a medal, how happy would you be?
Oh my God. Happy.
Is it easier when you're on your own?
Yeah.
And tell me what your favourite one is, the ball or the ribbon or the hoop?
The ball and the hoop.
Why is that?
With easier routines.
Kauthar Yaya is another member of the Connacht gymnastics team and she can't wait to take her place on the mat before the judges on Saturday morning.
When I go to double, I'll do fantastic. I've been waiting for this. I'll be confident, but I'll be nervous a little bit because there'll be a lot of people watching us because I like a lot of people. I like a lot of shouting.
People cheering you on.
Yeah, and clap. So I like all of that. So I'll be confident. Confident on the day.
And the best of luck to all the athletes. Pat McGrath reporting for Thursday's Morning Ireland. The writer Fiona Looney was Ray Darcy's guest on Thursday. She's obsessed with the beautiful game and the World Cup. But first of all, the conversation turned to a topic featured earlier on Ray's show.
What about sex education? Do you remember getting any sex education when you were a kid?
It's interesting, and I know people kind of shirk a little bit when they hear people using the bold words, as you know, because we would have been brought up thinking they were bold words, but the last time that they brought in a major change in primary school sex ed, I had a daughter, my youngest would have been kind of junior, senior infants, and they had a parents' meeting in the school, and the HSE, or I think it was a Relate or Accord or one of these ran the programme at the time. But anyway, very interesting woman stood up and said, we are going to be doing this. And she said, we will be teaching junior and senior infants the anatomically correct terms for the private parts. And there was nearly a riot amongst the parents in the hall. And one woman who was almost in tears just stood up and she said, I'm not having my four-year-old come home and tell me she has I can't even say the word. And the woman just really calmly said, and this is why we're teaching it to your children.
Hey.
And I just thought, touche, you know, because the very fact that we
can't say it
is a very good reason for kids to learn. And my teenagers, you know, my grown-up kids, they throw, of course, I'm still going to say these words, but they throw them around in the same way as they would say, I've got a sore elbow. You know, it has no power and they're not being mischievous, you know, or trying to be rude or be confrontational. It's just another word.
As it should be.
Yeah, as it should be.
Fiona Looney. Well, proper parenting was also discussed on the Ryan Tuberty show when one of Ryan's regular listeners rang in about the gaming craze. Alana's two daughters, aged 9 and 4, love the game Fortnite, but another listener took issue with this.
Interesting. And here's another one. A four-year-old playing Fortnite? Why is that woman laughing? The damage she is doing is huge. I'm fuming listening.
Oh, come here. You could wait until your kids are 12 and they'll mom shame you over something else. Like, I'm not
I've never heard this expression, mom shame.
No?
Tell me about it.
Oh my God, it's everywhere.
What is it?
It's just, you know, people weighing in on how other people should parent constantly. Like, you know, and like, I've never heard greater parenting advice than from people who aren't parents.
Go on.
You know, it's one of these things like that. You know, they're all saying, like, opinions are like, you know what, everyone has one. It's just everyone likes to judge, especially when it comes to parenting. Everyone thinks they know a better way of doing it.
And is that an online thing or is that just in life, in a coffee shop?
Yeah, it starts from pregnancy. You know, everyone likes to judge how someone's handling a pregnancy and then a birth and then breastfeeding and then just how you're parenting. It just always goes on. And it doesn't seem like dads don't seem to get it. It's really just like a mother-centric thing.
Mom shaming explained on the Ryan Tuberty show. Well, last Monday's Mooney Goes Wild was a special about ocean pollution, and Derek's guest was wildlife cameraman Gavin Thurston. Gavin has worked on 17 of David Attenborough's television series, including Blue Planet 2, for which he filmed most of the underwater sequences at depths of up to 1,000 metres. Derek wondered how often he came across creatures he couldn't identify.
I'd say pretty much every dive we would see something. We'd have no idea what it was. And a lot of those things might be, you know, the size of your fingernail. But there were other things. We came across this one extraordinary thing on the seabed. It was a sandy seabed, 1,000 metres down. And it looked like something out of an H.G. Wells novel. Like sort of rugby ball sized, orange. And it had all these sort of silken threads, you know, like guy ropes spreading out down onto the seabed, onto the sand to anchor it. And then above this sort of sponge body, the top sort of third of it was like a whole load of pistons pumping away, filtering the water, mm-hmm. like a radial of pistons. And then on the top of that, it was crowned with like a sea anemone thing. Anyway, of course, the pilot carefully positioned the sub next to it, so it was in our lights and in front of the cameras and started filming. And the whole while we're thinking, what the bloody hell is it? Anyway, clearly this creature didn't like being our lights. And so what it very slowly did is it let go with some of these guy ropes on one side. I say guy ropes, they're like silken threads or like jellyfish stinging tentacles, mm-hmm. yeah. And it retracted them. And then what it would do is it would just let them drift in the current and they would drift out maybe 1 or 2 metres until it hooked onto something. And slowly it would hook onto something more and more on that side and it would let go with tentacles the other side. And then it just basically pulled itself out of the lights and went off to one side. And then it settled down its guy ropes again and carried on feeding, thinking, I don't like that light in my eyes. But we showed the pictures to the scientist. Once we got up on board, we showed the pictures to him. And he said, God, that's amazing. And he said, I don't know what it is. And he emailed the pictures to 4 or 5 colleagues around the globe who he thought might know what it is. And they all emailed back and we were waiting for the results. And they said, we got no idea what it is. The theory is it was literally like a symbiotic relationship between a sponge, a siphonophore, and an anemone.
And did it ever get a name?
We called it Dave.
No.
From Mooney Goes Wild last Monday night. Well, one of the big political stories this week was the historic summit between US President Donald Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un in Singapore, a topic discussed by Sean O'Rourke on The Gathering with journalists Colette Brown and Michael O'Regan and politicians Damien English and Richard Boyd Barrett.
What did you make of Richard Boyd Barrett? By the analysis of most observers, the big winner was the North Korean chairman, because he got an agreement to suspend the war games between the Americans and the South Koreans. And he didn't really make any concessions himself.
Well, I think to demilitarise or denuclearise the Korean Peninsula is a very good thing from wherever it comes. And, you know, setting aside the theatrics and the volatility of Trump and indeed his dangerous volatility and all that, that you can't but welcome if it's real, right? If it isn't just PR stuff. But if the US military remove bases from Korea, that would be to be welcomed. If Korea does actually begin to wind down its nuclear programme, which quite frankly, I mean, you know, I think the threat to some extent was overblown when you think what sort of state and the state of the North Korean economy is in the first place. But nonetheless, if it demilitarizes the situation and de-escalates conflict on the peninsula, it's a good thing. The deeper point I would make is this is about a deal really between China and the United States to a very large extent. And it's about the realignment of geopolitical
and
power.
The academics and maybe the experts recoil at some of the, they might see as the vulgar or focusiness of what Donald Trump was saying. But even that clip I think we played at the start where he talks about, look, those wonderful beaches and think of all those hotels and real estate that could be there, bringing prosperity to the people. I mean, his base will presumably identify with that.
Yeah, well, you know, he'll be straight in with a Trump hotel and Trump golf course, presumably as soon as that happens. But I thought an interesting aspect of what went on was the kind of sneaking regard that Trump obviously has for Kim Jong-un. He talked about how it was very difficult for him when he took over from his father. He was only 26. He was very talented, and when, you know, the human rights abuses in North Korea were raised with him, he responded by saying that Kim Jong-un runs it tough.
It's rough.
Exactly. So, I mean, let's not forget we're talking about a dictator here.
Is the world a safer place three or four days after this
statement? I think the statement feels safer. I think it's fair to say a number of months ago when these guys were attacking each other across the social media, people were genuinely afraid. Even over here, people were kind of, where's this going to go? They were fearful. So, look, I'm not sure what will come out of this week, but people feel a little bit safer, a little bit calmer. It mightn't lead to great success.
He's a charming fellow.
Sitting down talking, it's a big help.
Charming fellow. The New York Times reported during the week that in the past 6 years he has ordered the execution of at least 340 people, including a general who fell asleep at a meeting. Now, Damien, if you fell asleep at a government meeting, and I know it wouldn't happen.
I can't confirm or deny. I
couldn't see Leo ordering your execution.
Well, Leo Varadkar has been Taoiseach for a year, and this week he was warning of a snap general election if a motion of no confidence by Sinn Féin and Housing Minister Owen Murphy were to go ahead.
Michael O'Regan, is there an election in this if Sinn Féin table that motion of no confidence in Owen Murphy?
There's no prospect of an election. I'd bet you in all Ireland that there'll be no election. No, and Galway are looking good this year.
For the double.
Indeed. There'll be no election. What is going on at the moment is juvenile political antics in Leinster House. The last people who want an election, by the way, are Sinn Féin. They have a new leader, Mary Lou MacDonald, who's doing very well, but she needs time to consolidate her position. Leo, of course, as cute an operator politically as Bertie was 20 years ago. The similarities are unbelievable. Leo is a very, very good political strategist, the way Bertie used to be. And of course, he scares the life out of people talking about a snap election. In the meantime, Sinn Féin saying, well, we might or we mightn't move the motion of no confidence. Fianna Fáil saying, oh, we'll have to look at this. This is summer pantomime, Sean, before they go off on their long summer holidays. There'll be no election. And I'll tell you why the voters wouldn't welcome one. The abortion legislation, by the way, has to be put through following the referendum. Now, the Minister of Health, Simon Harris, says the timescale would probably be towards the end of the year. Your Brexit, which is quite frightening economically for Ireland, that's ahead of us. You have Fianna Fáil, of course, committed to a third budget in October, so no election. Nonsense.
And John, just to add as well, I think what's happening here is Sinn Féin realised that the policies are beginning to work. So now they're attacking
I'm
the person.
I'm not too sure about that, David.
Well, that's what's going on.
From Today with Sean O'Rourke yesterday. Well, before I go, a story to put a smile on your face and set you dreaming. There were great celebrations yesterday as a syndicate of 32 colleagues from a hardware store in Thurles came to Dublin to collect their 17 million fortune, which they won in the Euro Millions draw. The man who kept the show on the road over the past 22 years, entering the draw and collecting the money, is Gerard Salmon, and he spoke with Conor Hunt.
I was actually at home after coming in from playing a few holes of golf, and I checked my phone and I saw on the news that there was a 17 million euro winner in Ireland, so I pulled out the ticket, and just the practicalities of it's easier to check the two lucky star numbers first, so I checked those and they were the same, and next thing I started going left to right across, and I went into the other room to meet my wife, and she I said, I think we've won the Euro Millions, and she said, you're joking, you know, it's surreal, first of all, because you really don't know what to feel.
There's 32 members in the syndicate. You'll each get around, I think it's around 530 grand each. What do you plan to do with that?
Me personally, my dream holiday is a cruise that goes out of Florida, a music cruise, a Kayamo cruise out of which would have country music singers, Buddy Miller, Emmylou Harris, Josh Ritter, all those. That's my dream holiday anyway.
Sounds good to me. From the News at One yesterday with Áine Lawler. Well, I hope you'll stay tuned for Richard Curran. He'll be here shortly after the 10 o'clock news with the business. But I leave you now with a song from The Stunning, who, apart from being Vicky Phelan's favourite band, also played live on Sunday with Miriam. Gramago Vasrogoluder, Tasulam Gurwanshev, Saltasaglar, Agus Gameshevlam, Taka and Amakena, Antachthan Chahugin, Gijishin, Gijeshap Slan.
Something about a sunrise. Open up the curtain, take a look. Out the door, we're shambling down the roadside, down to the lake where nature's waking up. I didn't think that we'd be talking all night. Drinking from the neck does you in. The beauty of the dawn makes me uptight. I haven't seen it since, I don't know when. I haven't seen it since, I don't know when. She moves through the morning. She moves on the air. I can feel her head on my shoulder. Turn around and she's not there. Turn around, she's not there. See the way she moves around the graveyard, stepping around the tombstones with respect, calling out the rhymes of the ones who died before their time. Michael, TB, aged 8. She never seems to look any older. Eyes that shine crystalline and bright. When she puts her head upon my shoulder, I feel as bold as Lancelot the Knight. Yeah, I feel as bold as Lancelot the Knight. She moves through the morning. She moves on the air. I can feel her head on my shoulder.